Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you this morning from the Bible. My name's Matt, one of the leaders here. This summer, 10 years ago, I was standing on the top of this mountain. As some of you might recognize it as the Half Dome in Yosemite National Park in California. And I would say it is the closest to death I've ever been. It's a scary thing to be up there, particularly because as you can see from it, that top part of the mountain is this sort of sheer boulder, and I didn't go up that vertical side, although you can do. Some people do climb up that side. You kind of go around it and then up the other side. So the next picture will show how you ascend the top bit. There's some steel cables that you can hold on to as you walk up there. But as you can see, the rock is very flat and very sheer, and there's nothing really to hold on to if you did sort of slip off. So it's definitely the closest to death I've ever come. We're talking this morning on the subject of fear. And I don't know about you, but this was quite scary for me. We've got another picture from going back down it on the other way as well. That's going back down. And you're just holding on to this cable. Fear of heights is coming to the surface for many of you right now. But in one sense, actually, fear was a good thing. It was a very natural thing, instinctive thing in this moment. But it was also a good thing because it made sure that I was being as careful as I could. The fear that I had made sure I held tightly to the cable and made sure I put my feet in the right place. I was traveling around America in the summer, and I just had my trainers with me, and I only went up this mountain because I was with some other people, and they said, "Oh, we're going up this mountain. Do you want to come?" And I was like, "Yeah, right." And I was just wearing my Vans trainers, which are not the most, it's not even walking boots. And I was about halfway coming up, and someone coming down, and they were like, "Oh, I wouldn't want to be doing this in those shoes." And that made me feel a lot better about it. But the fear that I had did help me in one sense. It's not a good place to be flippant there. So fear can be a good thing. But probably our most common, usual, day-to-day experience of fear is quite negative. It's quite unsettling. It's not something that we enjoy necessarily having. Fear, anxiety, worry. But it's something that we all do experience. We might not all fear exactly the same things, but we all experience it. And the series that we are starting today, and it's going to be sort of dotted through the next few months up until the summer, with this title of Fearless, it's all about how we stand firm in shaky times. That's the sort of subheading for it. And we do, I think you'll admit, live in quite uncertain times. So many events globally, nationally, that cause us some level of fear or worry or anxiety. Recently, we've had rhetoric from the United States and North Korea about nuclear war. Maybe that was a fear that we had decades ago, and it's come back to the fore. We live maybe with a fear of terrorism, as we see in the relatively safe Western world. Again, terrorist attacks challenging our safety, and maybe we're living with a sense of threat about what might happen. And we have economic uncertainty with the Brexit vote, and we've got elections coming up now, and there's lots of reasons out there that we are unsure about what's going to happen, and maybe we're living with worry and anxiety about that. It could be those sorts of things. It could be, and I'm sure it is also, things that we experience day to day on a personal level as well. We're worried about maybe our finances personally. Maybe we're worried about things at work or our job situation or not having a job. Or there might be worried about social situations. Or we're worried about our family or something might happen to them or they're going through a difficult time. There's so many different things that we can be worried and afraid of. And of course, I would think all of us in this room want to overcome our fears, not be dominated by them, but overcome them. Nelson Mandela said, "I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. And the brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he conquers that fear." Fear is something that we all experience, and I can't tell you this morning that I can give you a strategy or I can say some words that are going to eliminate fear in your life. I can't do that. All of us live with fear because actually, as I said at the beginning, fear can be a good thing. It can be a helpful thing. It's a natural, instinctive thing a lot of the time. But we can live in a way that's not dominated by fear and overcome fear to a certain extent and know peace from God that helps us live through scary times and helps us to handle our worries in a way that is good and right and helpful to us. We're going to be looking in this series at the book of Habakkuk, and it's towards the end of the Old Testament. It's maybe not a familiar book to many of you, whether you're new here or not. So this morning, if you do have a Bible with you, there is absolutely no shame in looking at the index to see what page Habakkuk turns up on. It's towards the end of the Old Testament, as I say, but feel free to turn to that now if you can. I'll give you a few minutes warning so you can find it, but the words will be on the screen as well. Now Habakkuk, as I said, it's maybe not a familiar part of the Bible story to you. We'll get to the verses in a minute. But actually, there's many similarities between the situation that he is in, Habakkuk, and the situation that we're in right now. Because what he is facing is a situation where evil in society seems to be prevailing. People are doing wicked things, and Habakkuk's complaint is that God doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. Evil is going unchecked. And there are many things that are going wrong in society, and he's frustrated with God. And maybe that's the way we can feel when we see what's on the news and we see what's happening in the world. And even in the individual fears that we have, say, God, you're not doing anything about the situation. I'm worried about this. There's something that might happen. There's something that is happening. It's causing me fear. What is God doing? He has that very complaint to God. And what we see in this passage is that God responds to him. And Habakkuk goes on a journey from a place of uncertainty, from a place of frustration, and through the book as we go through it over these next few months, to a place of trusting in God's sovereignty. Now let me read a few verses and I'll try and explain a few things to help us understand the context a little bit as we go. I'm going to start reading from verse 2 of chapter 1. Habakkuk's complaint, he says this, "O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you, God, will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save?" We've seen violence in our nation and in the world very clearly. "Why do you make me see iniquity, wrongdoing? And why do you idly look at wrong?" God doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. "Destruction and violence are before me, strife and contention arise, and so the law is paralyzed. Justice, fairness, a fair society, it never goes forth. The wicked surround the righteous." So there seems to be some good people that are being faithful to God, but they are in the minority. The wicked surround the righteous, and justice goes forth perverted. That's the situation. Habakkuk is living amongst the nation of Judah, who are supposed to be God's people, supposed to be faithful to God, supposed to have a relationship with God and know his favor on their lives. But in this part of the story, the Old Testament story is all about this nation of Israel and Judah and their relationship to God and the ups and downs that they go through. This part of the story is where Judah have turned their back on God. And they've turned into evil ways. And Habakkuk is saying, they're doing wrong and you're not doing anything about it. Now, Habakkuk was a prophet. And a prophet stands in a unique position of standing in between a people, nation, and God himself. And the prophet speaks to God. And amazingly, God speaks to the prophet as well. And verse 5, we pick up God's answer to Habakkuk's complaint. He says this, "Look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, for I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. For behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans." Now the Chaldeans, that's another name for them would be the Babylonians. And if you know maybe something about the Bible, you'll know the story of Daniel. And he was taken into captivity in Babylon. The Babylonian army, the nation rose up and overtook God's people of Judah and conquered them and took many captives. And that's what happens to Daniel. he ends up in the lion's den and King Nebuchadnezzar and all that sort of thing. Okay, that happens soon. This is just before that. God's saying this is what's going to happen. He's going to raise up this nation who are evil as a judgment against Judah. For behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. We'll just leave it there. But as I say, with this book, Habakkuk goes from a place of being frustrated to a place of trusting and recognizing God's sovereignty, God's control over everything in the world. And as we see here, God's answer to his complaint slash prayer slash frustration isn't what Habakkuk was expecting. And Habakkuk wrestles with that answer and says, why, how can, is it fair that you raise up this other evil nation to punish Judah, who are bad, but not as bad as the Babylonians? And I'll try and address that kind of frustration and question that God could use evil in his plans. That's a difficult thing for us to come to terms with. I'll try and address that before we finish. But the trajectory of Habakkuk is he finds a place of contentment, and I hope that we do as well as we look at this book. I'm a school teacher at the minute, and we are approaching exam season. I teach maths in a local school here in Brighton, and it's very obvious as I teach my GCSE class which of them are dealing with fear in the right way. They've all got their exams coming up, and there's kind of three categories. There is one category of people that they're nervous about their exams. They're a bit afraid of what's coming, but they're responding to that in the right way, of it's motivating them to do the revision and pay attention in class and do extra work and that sort of thing. There's another camp of people that are in panic mode. They're overwhelmed by the fact that they've got all these GCSEs coming up, and they feel they've not done enough, and they're overwhelmed by anxiety and fear. And that's not a helpful place to be in. It's not going to help them with the preparation for these exams. And there's another camp of people that are just in denial. They're acting confident, acting like they don't care about it, but really they're just in denial that it's actually happening. And they're responding to the source of fear, their exams, but just trying to ignore the significance of it. And I think that's sort of three helpful categories for us to consider this topic of fear and ways that we can respond to the fear that we have in our lives. And I'm going to address each of them: too much fear, too little fear, and responding to fear in the right way. Firstly, I want to talk for a few minutes about having too little fear, denial. Maybe we might see it as escapism. That's one way of responding to fear. When we see things on the news that are unsettling, one solution to that is to turn the news off. Avoid watching it. If there are people in our lives that make us anxious and worried, we can avoid them. If our job or career is too stressful, or it is causing us anxiety, a solution is just to backtrack, to quit that job and find another job. We can go through life and try to avoid the sources of fear. We can avoid taking risks. We can avoid making decisions because we don't want to go down a route that's kind of scary. And that's what Judah, in one sense, this nation, were doing. They weren't coming to terms with the reality of what disobedience against God looked like and what the consequences for that were. They were living lives of escapism. They thought, oh, just forget about who we're supposed to be. Forget about the way we're supposed to live. We're just going to live for now. And we can do that. We can live a life of escapism, or just individual days or moments of escapism. We can escape into watching television, or escape into films, or escape into a hobby, because we just want to block out the things that are difficult in our lives or causing us to fear. And it can look impressive in one sense. It can look like we're conquering fear and we're living without fear. You know, sometimes the people that are seemingly most confident are actually the ones that are most afraid, but they're just trying to ignore and deny the sources of fear in their lives. I like a twist on the famous saying: if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs, then you haven't come to terms with the seriousness of the situation. Fear can look Absence of fear can look impressive, but really you're not facing up to reality. You're not coming to terms with what's actually happening. And so therefore, it's not a long-term solution. We can try to suppress these fears that we have, but that's not a long-term solution because they're still there under the surface. They're still there when no one's looking. They're still there when we're awake at night. As much as we try to ignore them, they come back. Because the reality is our fears aren't random. They're not just things that pop up out of nowhere. They actually link to who we are as people. Now, as I said, all of us in the room don't exactly have exactly the same fears. There'll be some things that are similar, but we have fears that are slightly different. And they're not random because they link to the big questions about who we are. Judah were trying to ignore the big questions about who they're supposed to be as God's people. And they're trying to live for the moment and live a life of escapism. But if we think about our fears and think about what we're afraid of, and if we go a little bit deeper, if we sort of pull the thread, as it were, to see where our fears come from, we get to the big questions about who we are, our identity, and the value that we have. So, for example, say that we have worries, anxiety about our career. Whether, you know, all of us might be nervous when it comes to a job interview or your performance management review or that sort of thing. Okay. In one sense, there's a natural level of fear of having to speak in front of people or explain things and that sort of thing. But actually, the deeper fears underneath that are like, well, if I mess this up or my performance management doesn't go well or if I lose my job or if my boss becomes upset with me, what does that say about who I am? We all want our lives to be successful. That might look different for different ones of us, but we want to be successful. We want to have a sense of value, that we're doing something in life, that we're contributing something, or we want others to see us as a success. No one wants to be a failure, but our fears are actually linked to that worry and question mark over our lives. Am I successful? Am I admired? Because if I am, then I'm a valuable person. Then my life has significance. And if I'm not, I can't even face that reality. And that's why we really get nervous about those things, because what it says about us as people and our identity might not be work, it might be friendships. We might be nervous about social situations or a particular person's opinion about us. And we might not want to say the wrong thing or be seen to be doing something because, well, what will they say about me? They might not like me. They might not value me. And if they don't value me, then I'm not a valuable person. I'm not worthy of people's attention. I'm not worthy of people's love, admiration, all those things. We can try and live in denial, but we have big questions over our lives that need to be answered. And our fears are clues to the things that really matter and the clues to what's really going on in our hearts and minds. And we know that they really matter at the end of the day. We want to live lives of significance. And actually, God knows it as well. And God, in this passage of Habakkuk, it's a very stark picture of God's judgment. That he's saying the way you live matters. They try to ignore it, but God is coming with a judgment against them. And we don't like that idea. That's a scary idea. And when we look in the Bible, we think, God, is he really like this, that he would judge? But it all plays into this idea that actually we know our lives matter. We want lives of significance. And the reason that we do is because actually underneath it, whether we like to admit it or not, our lives do have eternal significance and eternal consequences. Let me use this by way of illustration. Catherine and I were watching on Netflix recently the O.J. Simpson American Crime Story. It's a dramatization of the O.J. Simpson murder trial back from the early 90s. I didn't know anything really about the trial apart from that he gets acquitted at the end. It was called the Trial of the Century at the time. And it's a really good series. We really enjoyed watching it, but there's a number of different dynamics that are going on. Firstly, his life gets scrutinized, not just by a judge and jury, but by the whole, almost the whole world, certainly the whole country. It's the highest profile murder case probably of all time. And stuff gets out in the media and different evidence gets put out there and different people are saying things. And virtually everyone in the country had an opinion on whether they thought he was guilty or not guilty. And that idea, if you think about yourself in that position, take the crime out of the way for the minute, but just to think that if whether you would like your life scrutinized by the whole world, oh, the things that you had done and the things that you had said, presented before people, we find that very uncomfortable, that our lives and our motivations, what we've done, would be scrutinized. We don't like that idea, and we don't like this idea of judgment, and we wouldn't like to be in that sort of situation. But at the same time, we have these two responses. We don't like to be judged, but we do like judgment. We do like fairness. We do like the sense that justice is done. And this really came home to me when watching this, because I knew that he gets acquitted at the end. And you might say, well, why are you watching it if you know what happens at the end? Doesn't it spoil the ending of the series? But what's interesting about the series as it goes on episode by episode is that what seems at first a really clear case of guilt and all the evidence is pointing at him, episode by episode, bits of the evidence get marred and other things come into play, and you see, tragically, this case slipping away. And things that are not based on evidence and fact become bigger factors and influence the situation, and it's almost painful to watch that you see that justice is not going to get done. He's going to get off here. This is not fair. And we want to live in a just society. We want to live in a fair society. But we don't like the idea that we will face judgment. But actually, the fears that we have are clues that our lives really matter. And actually, they point us to the fact that our lives matter eternally, that we will all have to answer to God for the way that we have lived. And we can try and live in denial. We can try and pretend that they don't matter, but we know deep down that they do, and living in denial can't be a long-term solution. Let me move on now to the other extreme, living with too much fear, being overwhelmed by fear. This is a real and growing issue in our society, even in this country. Last year, a report came out, a research came out that all the mainstream newspapers picked up on, and the headline was an anxiety epidemic. Levels of anxiety are growing fast. 8 million people in the country have an anxiety disorder right now. It's on the rise. One in five, I was looking at some statistics this week, one in five sick days in this country are to do with mixed anxiety and depression. It's affecting our work, it's affecting our lives, it's affecting the decision that we make, and particularly it is affecting young people. Particularly this is prevalent amongst those under the age of 35. And you might think, in the world that we live now, with all the technology and smartphones and social media, all the opportunities for travel and the opportunities that are open to young people, and they seem to be thriving, they've got opportunities that generations before them never had. But what's happening is that all those things are coming at them, the pace of life is coming at them, and it's out of control. They can't control things. It gives us the illusion that we're in control by giving us all this opportunity and having information at the touch of our fingers, but we're overwhelmed with it, and we're overwhelmed with life, and we come to a place of anxiety. And I can talk about the facts, and I can talk about the statistics. I can also speak from my own experience. I was someone who, growing up, struggled with nervousness, anxiety. It got to a stage, I was about 18 years old, and just starting in the workplace, anxiety affected my life every single day. Social situations, meeting people. I remember even just going to work. Nothing was particularly happening at work. It was a very boring job. It had no responsibility at all. I remember one morning I was lying on my bed, literally shaking with nerves before going to work. And millions of people around the world right now, and maybe even in this room, you face that every day. anxiety can grip us, can overwhelm us. That's not all of us, though. But all of us are affected by fear. How many decisions do you make in your life because of fear? How many decisions do you make because of fear? How many times do you stay late at work or work more than you should do and it's healthy to do because you're worried about what might happen if you don't? You're worried about what your boss will say. You're worried about your job security. So you do something that you really know it's not good for you to do, but you're worried about what might happen if you don't. How many times do we agree with people in social situations or whatever because we just go along with what they're saying because we don't want to disrupt, we don't want to disagree with someone and cause awkwardness or what might happen, people not liking us. How often do you put off a big decision that you need to make because what might happen if I do this? Fear can affect our decisions. How many times do you say yes to your kids when you know you should say no because you don't want to upset them? You're fearful, anxious of what might happen, that relationship potential breakdown if you say no rather than saying yes, even though it's the right thing to do. And we can dwell in the what ifs in life rather than what's right. And we think about what if this happens, what if this happens. We can be afraid, and we are afraid of the things that we don't have control over. We're fearful of health. Maybe you're fearful of dying, of being unwell, or someone that you know being unwell. We can be fearful about our kids. Are they going to be safe? Are they going to be happy in life? We might be fearful about making ends meet. There are a list and list and list, so many fears that we might have and that I know that you do have. And you know what? Being a Christian sometimes makes it feel like it's even worse. Because like Habakkuk is praying here, we worry about something. There's something happening or potentially happening in our lives and we think, right, okay, the Bible says, don't worry, pray. Okay, so I'm going to try that. So I'm going to not worry about it. God, this situation's happening. Please sort it out. Please sort it out. Please sort it out. Give me peace. And then nothing changes. And that's exactly the tone of Habakkuk's prayer. You are idle. He's a bit more impolite than maybe we would be. But he says, you're not doing anything. And then, so okay, God's not doing anything. Right, I'll pray about it more. God, help me with this. Get me through this. Sort this out. God's not doing anything. And we can get in a cycle. It actually makes us even more worried than we were before. Because God doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. How do we overcome this? How do we get through this? It can't just be about, right, try not to be worried about it and try and pray about it instead. There's something more to it. Well, there is. I want to return to these verses for this solution here. How can we get to a place of trust that overcomes fear? Well, notice in these verses here, I'll read it out to you again, how many times Habakkuk talks about himself. Oh Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? Why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me, and strife and contention arise. What we see from this kind of prayer is actually, it's a self-centered prayer, really. He's saying, God, this situation is bad for me, and you're not doing anything about it. And that's making me frustrated. And that's getting me to a place of despair, even. And that is the heart of the problem. And it can manifest itself in praying, or it can manifest itself in just worrying. But really, we are the center of the story. The center of the narrative that's going on in our hearts or in our minds. I'm worried about this. This might happen to me or my family, and I can't control it, and it's causing me worry. It's causing me anxiety. God, do something about it, because I can't do anything about it. You need to do something about it. But really, we're trying to exercise control. And that's the same reason why so many young people are struggling with anxiety right now in this country, is because they've been given the illusion of control that you can do anything in life. You're in charge of your own destiny. And that is too big a thing for any of us to handle. Because immediately we think, what if I mess it up though? What if I don't reach my goals? What if I disappoint people along the way? What if I miss the chance that I had and I'll regret it for the rest of my life? the more we're given, the more is expected, and we can't meet those expectations, and we get to a place of despair. We want to be in control, and we can never have control. What is the solution? The solution is to give everything up to Him and relinquish all control to God, not just the things that we're worried about. Not just the things that we're worried about, but everything. And that was my story, and that was my journey about a year after the situation when I was 18 that I just described. I got to a stage, I would say I was a Christian up to that point, but I got to a stage in life that said, my life is in your hands, God. I can't continue anymore trying to live my own life and trying to make my own plans. Whatever you want me to do, I'm going to do. Whatever you want me to go, I'm going to go. And I'm just giving it all over to you and complete surrender to Him. And I'm not saying my life has been worry-free from that moment on, but that is a huge step, and it's one that we need to take, because we are not built to control our own lives. We're not built to be in charge of our own destiny. We are built, made by God, and given a destiny to live with Him, to enjoy Him, and to worship Him forever. And all the ups and downs of career and family and things that go on along the way are good, and God blesses us with them, but He doesn't ask us to control them. And we have to give up control to all of those things. And that is a once-in-a-lifetime decision, but it's also a daily decision as well. We need to keep looking up, not looking at ourselves, not looking at what we can do, what we can control, not looking at the situation, but looking up to Him. And here's a little illustration from my son in the park the other day. And he was on the climbing frame, and he always goes for stuff that is too small. But I thought it was a good picture. He's fearless in that moment because he's looking at, he doesn't care about the fact how small he is. He doesn't care about the fact that he's having to, he could drop down in between those ropes. He's just looking up. And I want you to remember that. That is the pose of someone who is living life fearlessly. They're not so concerned about themselves. They're not so concerned about what they're facing. They're so concerned about God and what He's done and who He is and who He's made them to be. Now, in one sense, you knew that I was going to say this, even if you've only been in church, never. You knew that I was going to say, the answer to fear is trusting God and focusing on Him. And of course it is, but I do want to spend the last few minutes that I've got with you this morning to really unpack that and really get to grips with what it actually looks like. I don't want to send you away this morning with just a platitude of, well, don't worry about it, look to God or look up, but really think about how that plays out day to day. Because what Jesus has done on the cross is died for our sin and our shame and our weakness and our brokenness, and wants us to live in freedom. Okay, and I'm not saying that you can go out from this place this morning and never fear again. But I do want you to go out from this morning and never let a fear in your life go unchallenged. And unchallenged by the truth of God and what He says about you and what He has done for you through the cross and through His resurrection. So let me give some examples. Performance at work. Our career, or what we're doing day to day in the office or wherever it is, and that can so be a source of worry, anxiety, fear, and that sort of thing. And when we're facing that performance management review and we're thinking, okay, I'm really nervous about this, unpick that fear that you're facing. Why am I really upset about this or anxious about this? Well, because if I don't do well, then I'm a failure. No, you're not. Who says? The enemy, the devil, says, he preys on your fears and tells you something that's not true. And the daily walk of the Christian is to challenge every fear and bat away those lies with the truth about what God says. Because your whatever career, job you have, your purpose is not to be a success in that role. Your purpose in life is to live for God, no matter what job you have. I don't have to, you know, I don't want to sound that I've got this sorted, but literally in school during the week, other teachers say to me, Matt, you're so happy, you don't seem to get stressed. And I try and explain and say, well, I've got a different reason for my identity. If my kids do well, the kids that I teach do well at GCSE, great. If they don't, yeah, I'll be disappointed. But that doesn't mean I'm a failure. It doesn't mean that my identity has changed because I've done not as well as I could have done or something that's happened that reflects badly on me. It doesn't change who I am. And I have to remind myself every single morning before I go into work who I am and what God has done for me. And the fact that my identity comes because he has died for me on the cross and he loves me and he's given me a purpose from that point to live for him now. And I might do well at work and I might not do well at work, but it doesn't change who I am. And that brings that fear level right down. It really does. It's a daily walk of reminding ourselves what God has done. We can be so caught, let me give another example, we can so be caught up in the way we appear to others and social situations. We can be nervous, we can worry, what do people think of me? Maybe you're holding back from joining a small group because you don't want to be honest with other people. You don't want other people to get to know you because you're worried about what they might think and they might judge you and all those sorts of things. We all have those worries. But how do we challenge that? We say, well, yeah, they might not like you. Is that the end of the world? God likes you. If you're a Christian, he loves you. He likes you. He's chosen to go to the cross for you so you can be with him forever in his small group. That reduces the level of fear right down. We say, okay, yeah, people might not like us. Or maybe they do, maybe they don't. But I'm not pinning my identity to other people's perception of me. You've got to daily pin it to something that's far better. And as I said, you can eliminate fear from your life, but you can challenge it. And we have fears. Well, maybe you've got fears about ill health. Or someone in your family or friend having ill health, or your kids or something like that. And they are real fears, and you're going to face them. But how do we challenge them? We challenge them with the faithfulness of God. Okay, well, what, you know, even if I die, Jesus has given us a hope beyond the grave. I know it sounds simple to say and very difficult to do, and it is difficult to do, but it's a case of daily dwelling in the hope that he has won for us at the cross and through his resurrection. That cancer is not the end of the story. That he has promised something greater, that sin and death has been defeated, and we forget these things. And it's every morning, every day, saying, I don't need to worry. Not just, don't tell yourself I'm not going to worry. Say, I don't need to worry. I don't need to fret about this. I'm going to choose to dwell on what God has done. And I'm going to see it in the light of a faithful God. A God who loves me. Our sinful desire is to be in control of our lives and try and manipulate things. And when we can't manipulate things or when we can't have as much control as we like, we feel afraid of them. The irony is, we want to be number one, and Jesus turns that all upside down and he goes to the cross. He makes you his number one concern. And we can take our hands off, okay? I don't need to be my number one concern in life because Jesus already done that. And he's died for my sin and he's died for my weakness, and I'm going to be with him forever. And I'm trusting my life to his faithfulness. And he did that at the cross so that we can live in freedom. We can live in freedom from that fear. Amen. Amen. Let me pray for us. Father, we are so grateful that you have stepped into our world, not just to show us how to live, not to raise the bar, but to go to the cross that we might find forgiveness and new life in Jesus. And Jesus, you said that you've come that we might have peace and life to the full. And Lord, I pray for each person in this room right now, Lord, that they might live life to the full, that is not overwhelmed by fear, not trying to deny the things that are real in our lives, but living in a way that trusts you by bringing every thought and every fear under the truth of Christ and what he's done. And I pray, Lord, if there's any in this room that are living in the grips of fear, that you would break chains.
right now, Lord. And if there's any in this room that have yet to give their life over to you, Lord, that you'd give them the faith right now to trust what you've done at the cross, that they could live in relationship with you, find their purpose and identity and destiny in what you've done for them and what you say about them, that they might live with you and walk with you all the days of their life. In Jesus' name, amen.